Here's how it works. The quadrennial meeting of the Electoral College of the United States.
It is your solemn responsibility to translate into a formal document for transmission to the Congress of the United States the decision of the voters.
Quote, to translate to a formal document for transmission to the Congress of the United States the decision of the voters. Well, that's from the 2008 meeting of the Electoral College in Pennsylvania, formalizing Barack Obama's win as 44th president.
In hallowed halls, just like in here today in this House chamber today, throughout the nation, electors will likewise cast their votes and validate our Constitution and the rule of law.
But there's a wrinkle. There's always a wrinkle.
Electors will also have the opportunity, if they so choose, to vote for other candidates, because you don't really have to vote for the individuals that have selected you to represent them, although I think you probably should. And regardless, at the end of this national effort, we'll have one president, we'll have one vice president, and we'll have one nation.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today on Point, well, today is the day. December 14th, 2020, the day for this election, when the women and men of the Electoral College meet to formally cast their votes for the 46th president of the United States. 306 votes for Joe Biden, 232 for Donald Trump. From here, there's one more stop. Congressional certification in early January. But oh, look! There's White House Senior Advisor Stephen Miller on Fox News this morning, spewing lies about a fraudulent election and doing everything he can to defy what the electors said back in 2008 about having one nation at the end of this national effort.
The only date in the Constitution is January 20th. So we have more than enough time to right the wrong of this fraudulent election result and certify Donald Trump as the winner of the election. As we speak today, an alternate slate of electors in the contested states is going to vote, and we're going to send those results up to Congress.
Bertrall Ross, what is Stephen Miller even talking about?
You know, I think that this is part of the longstanding narrative of fraud that the Trump campaign has put out. And I think the thinking is that if you say it enough times, it will be. What the Constitution does say is that on January 20th, a new person will be put into the White House, or whoever won the election in November will be put into the White House. And what I think Stephen Miller is referring to are the opportunities in the way for the Trump campaign to try to overturn these elections with long shot bids that have very little likelihood of success. Today, there's the Electoral College's meeting, and I guess there might be a long shot hope that there'll be enough so-called faithless electors to overturn the election, but that is extraordinarily unlikely. And then there's on January 6th when Congress needs to certify the electors, and there's a hope and a long shot bid to have Congress overturn the election results, which is not going to happen.
But let's be clear about something. Stephen Miller is telling Fox News viewers that the Trump administration, or Trump campaign, is trying to get state governments around the country in certain quote unquote contested states to put forth an alternative slate of electors for Congress to consider on January 6th. Can they even do that?
They cannot unless they declare that their election was a failed election. The Electoral Count Act does give state legislatures, if their elections fail, the opportunity to select their own slate, select the slate of electors that they want to send to Congress. But these elections have been certified in enough states and all the states to give Joe Biden the Electoral College victory. And therefore, there is no opportunity for the states to declare a failed election and to send a different slate, an alternative slate of electors to Congress.
So legally speaking, what Stephen Miller says is going to happen simply cannot happen because the 50 states have certified their elections, just to be clear.
That's exactly right.
So he's just lying.
He is.
All right. Well, this is Bertrall Ross. And for regular listeners of On Point, which I know you all are, you'll know that he is Chancellor's Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley, and a member of the Ad Hoc Committee for 2020 Election Fairness and Legitimacy. And Professor Ross has joined us multiple times over the course of 2020 to, you know, give us a reality check on election law, where the strengths of our systems are, where the weaknesses are, the things that could go wrong, the challenges that we could see. He joined us in the spring and the summer. And he's back with us now. Professor Ross, welcome back to the show.
Megan, it's great to be with you always.
And of course, we are talking today because today is the day. As I mentioned, this is the day that the Electoral College meets to formally cast their electoral votes. And I want to bring in another voice to sort of talk about where America is right now with us. Jason Stanley also joins us. He's a professor of philosophy at Yale and author of several books, including How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them, and How Propaganda Works. Jason Stanley, welcome to you.
Thanks so much, Magna.
So where do you see Stephen Miller's abject lies on Fox News this morning about a fictional, fantastical, alternative slate of electors coming from contested states? Where do you see that in the spectrum of language and strategy that we've seen unfold in the 2020 election?
Well, minimally, it's an attempt to undermine the legitimacy of the election and undermine the legitimacy of the result and set the stage for 4 years of not respecting President Biden's administration and their nominees. So it's an attempt to treat the political opposition as not legitimate, and the only legitimate political actors on this point of view and are Republicans and in particular Republicans connected to Donald Trump. It's a longstanding strategy, not specific to the Trump administration, dates back to Newt Gingrich at least, of regarding Democratic politicians as illegitimate. Hannah Arendt warns of loyalty to party over parties, meaning loyalty to party over a multi-party democracy. And unfortunately, too many Republicans have that attitude to the detriment of the capacity to govern in this country.
Well, I'm really eager to hear both of you actually and speak with each other as well, because today with the two of you, I'm seeking to bring together both the letter and the spirit of the law and where our democracy is right now at that confluence. So Bertrand Ross, just feel free to respond to what Jason Stanley said. I mean, do you share those same concerns?
I do. And I think that what makes this potentially more insidious and threatening is the othering that is going on with respect to the Republican Party as directed towards the Democratic Party is potentially more effective as our parties have become more racially polarized. So to the extent that you are seeking to suggest that members of the other party are not legitimate voters, are not so-called real Americans, then that argument perhaps gets strength for some members of the Republican Party on the basis of the fact that many of those who voted Democratic were Black and brown individuals in our country. And so that's what's particularly worrisome in terms of the strategy right now. And we're seeing this as reflected in what happened with the protests this weekend in Washington, D.C., in which the target of Trump supporters were historically Black churches that had Black Lives Matter banners on their churches, tearing those down, burning them. These parts of the conflict are what make it more worrisome for our democracy.
Now, Jason Stanley, turn back to you in just a second, but I just want to lay a little bit of factual groundwork with Bertrand Ross of what happens between now and early January, when Congress meets to certify the Electoral College's vote. So really, that January 6th, I believe, is the next step, right, Bertrand?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
And are there wrenches that could be thrown into the system between now and then?
No, not really. I mean, the process in the past has been one in which it's been rather non-eventful. The Electoral College electors meet on the date in December, in which they cast their electoral votes for the winner of their particular state. And then Congress has a responsibility in early January to certify the electors. Right. And there's really nothing that it should be happening, given that the election has been certified in each of the states.
Now, so but when Congress does meet to certify, members of Congress have the opportunity to raise objections or call for debate over the certification. And that has happened before in the past. In fact, it happened with, I think, Democratic members of Congress doing so. Members of the House, but it requires a senator to also agree. And that has never happened. Is that right?
That is correct. Right. And, you know, this could be the unprecedented election in which it does happen, in which a senator does sign on. There are several senators in the United States Senate who have indicated that they might sign on. And if they do choose to sign on, then that, you know, opens up the debate over whether the electors should be certified or the process by which these electors are counted. But it's still not going to lead to the overturn of this election. The fact is, the House is controlled by Congress. The Senate is controlled by the Republicans. But there are Republicans in the Senate who have indicated this election was valid. And therefore, we should move on and certify these electors. And so I think that there will be bipartisan support for certifying these electors come January.
Well, Jason Stanley, what I see here is the machinery of American democracy trying to move forward against these battering headwinds of the attempts to delegitimize or at least undermine the trust that people have in the system. And what impact can that have in the long run?
Well, first of all, I want to say how affirming it is in recent weeks to talk to law professors who univocally have Professor Ross's message that they can't do it. It's not going to happen. Whenever I get too anxious, I give one a call. But I think I think it's alarming how close we came. I mean, the election was just the victory was too large on Biden's behalf for this sort of malfeasance to take effect. But I mean, the number of things that Trump attempted, from calling the leaders of the House and Senate of Michigan to the White House, etc.
Well, Stanley, just hang on for just a second. I have to take a quick break. I'll let you finish that thought. When we come back, today is the day that the electors of the Electoral College meet. We're taking a look at what happens and what could happen next in this democracy stress test the nation's undergoing. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today is the day that the women and men of the Electoral College meet to cast their electoral votes for president of the United States. So on this day, we are taking a look at how the nation has been faring in what feels like a democracy stress test in 2020. And I'm joined today by Bertrall Ross. He's Chancellor's Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley, and by Jason Stanley, who's a professor of philosophy at Yale and author of several books, including How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. And Jason Stanley, before the break, you were going through a couple of observations of things that have happened this year to continue to undermine trust in the system. And I'm sorry I had to interrupt you there for the break, but continue your thought.
No worries. I mean, let's go back to the main issue, which is undermining the trust in democracy. I mean, what we have is we have a kind of open anti-democratic sentiment that is behind the vocabulary of democracy. The Republican Party, many Republicans are saying they're trying to protect democracy by overthrowing an election. What that does is it reveals the democratic vocabulary to be kind of empty. To be meaningless. Democracy is supposed to be about rights, majority rule, equality. And this misuse of democracy to mean only we are legitimate, only the real Americans get to vote, It undermines democracy in a way that that is familiar from the 20th century. When the Soviet Union would attack the United States, they would say democracy is hypocritical. It's not real because of the reality of racism and extreme racial inequality and Jim Crow. And what we're seeing is something similar here. Like, if democracy just means the Republicans get to rule, what does democracy mean anymore?
Hmm. Well, Bertrand Russ, as you know, President Trump himself, but his supporters, his legal team, certain members of Congress have consistently been saying all he's doing, all they're doing is exercising the president's right to bring cases to court, that is his right to seek legal remedy. So what's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with that to the extent that these cases are being brought to court that have some factual basis supporting the claims that they're bringing, the fraud claims that they're alleging in court. To the extent that you are just bringing cases to court, you're using, without any factual basis, you're using essentially the court as a prop and court filings as props to legitimize the campaign to undermine the election, to undermine democracy. What you're seeing is a pattern in which the Trump campaign and his supporters are making great hay and celebrating the filing of cases in court. And filing of cases in court, that's essentially meaningless unless these cases actually go through and are adjudicated in favor of the party that's bringing the case to court. And none have, except for one very minor case in Pennsylvania. And so what I worry about is the court being brought into it as a tool to advance this campaign through the court filings.
Okay, so Jason Stanley, talk about that another institution of American democracy, in Bertrand Russ's words, being brought into a campaign of delegitimizing.
Absolutely. So you see this in authoritarian takeovers all over the world. You first seek to take the judiciary. Look at Poland, look at Hungary, look at India. You first seek to dominate the judiciary and then turn it into a partisan court. So I think that here, many of the appointees have actually not gone that way and have not allowed themselves to be delegitimized. But what we see here is we see an undermining of all of these institutional ideals, which is kind of without the horrors of Nazi Germany. There's a concept of Gleichschaltung that's useful here, where you transform independent institutions into partisan fealty courts, and thereby you undermine the meaning of those institutions. If law and order means what this particular political party wants, if democracy means these people should be in charge, then those concepts don't have the meaning they originally have. As Professor Ross rightly says, it undermines them. And to use that vocabulary to say we are using law and order, we're using the courts, it really an attempt to undermine the legitimacy of an independent judiciary.
So let's just talk for a second about two specific instances of that we just saw this weekend. Okay, so first of all, Bertrand, the Wisconsin Supreme Court held a Saturday session this weekend to actually hear witnesses or evidence from President Trump's legal team about, you know, that their claims of problematic outcomes in the Wisconsin election. But when this hearing happened, the Trump team neither brought witnesses nor evidence. And ultimately, the Wisconsin Supreme Court just threw it out. You want to talk a little bit about that?
It just shows, again, that the victory is the hearing or the filing alone. Without any subsequent action by the court, the Trump campaign and his supporters are declaring victory and are claiming legitimacy for their campaign to undermine the election by the fact of these simple calling of hearings, for example. And so it serves no legal purpose. It's simply a political purpose. It's a political purpose in which they seek to sell their supporters on the idea that these claims are making progress because they are receiving a hearing, because these filings are being made. And through that claim that they're making progress to their supporters, it further fuels this notion from of that the vote was stolen, that the election was stolen in some particular way. And that is, again, a particularly dangerous path for us to be on, because it sets us on a path over the next 4 years in which there is going to be a proportion of the American people, a minority, but a proportion of the American people who will continue to believe this notion because there were these court filings and these court hearings on it that suggest something nefarious was going on.
Yeah. So before we move to what happened in the Supreme Court, I just want to say that U.S. District Judge Brett Ludwig, who was appointed by President Trump, just basically said that the Trump's arguments, quote, fail as a matter of fact and law. And then in the Wisconsin Supreme Court, Justice Jill Karofsky said, what you want is for us to overturn this election so that your king can stay in power. That is so un-American. So moving to the Supreme Court's decision then to not hear that challenge from Texas about the allegation that results in other states somehow impacted Texas voters. Jason Stanley, what's your thought about the fact that this case was even brought or attempted to be heard in front of the Supreme Court?
Well, I think Professor Ross has put his finger on it. I think it's an attempt to give the sheen of legal respectability to these arguments that they can then carry forward to hopefully convince more senators that it's politically viable and congresspeople that it's politically viable to claim that the election was illegitimate. It's a fight for political viability using the cover of the legal terms and democratic terms, thereby emptying them of meaning. So soon when people hear, oh, it was in court or, oh, it was democratic, they'll just roll their eyes. Those concepts won't have power anymore. They're trying to give this a kind of legal sheen of respectability. But as Professor Ross said, the fight is entirely political.
Bertrand Ross, you want to comment on that?
I completely agree with Professor Stanley in terms of putting that sheen of respectability. I couldn't put it better. And I think that what it does, again, for the courts as institution is to the extent that they are not going along with this parody, it provides those supporters of Trump and the campaign to delegitimize the election are going to now start targeting the court as they have started targeting other institutions like secretaries of states and governors, even of their own parties, for not going along with this idea that the election was stolen. And so to the extent that the court gets dragged down into this, it poses a threat to its independence. And as Professor Stanley, it becomes, even through a back door, seen as a partisan institution that is very harmful to our whole system of rule of law that we have set up as a pillar of our democracy.
Okay, so then how do you protect an institution then? Because by definition, we're all in agreement here that Americans have a right to bring suits to court. I mean, the Supreme Court just declined to hear this case in particular. But have we come to the point where we're saying that even just bringing these lawsuits is somehow so potent of an idea that it's like a poison in the democratic body of the United States? That's a little challenging, honestly, Professor Ross.
Yeah, I think that there's two things that could be done. First is educating the American people as to what is going on with these lawsuits. And I think that the media has done a decent job. But the fact is that we have a very stratified media apparatus and the American public are divided in their media loyalties. And so some sources are conveying the news of what's happening in these suits in a legitimate and factual way, and some are not. But then there's the other part with respect to lawyers' ethical responsibilities. There's in law, there's a rule that prohibits frivolous lawsuits, or that provides a means for sanctioning the bringing of frivolous lawsuits by lawyers. And so the sanction goes to the lawyers for bringing these frivolous lawsuits, and there are potential consequences for their license as lawyers, for state bars to potentially disbar are these individuals to the extent that they act in unethical ways. I think that there has to be some penalty placed on lawyers to fulfill their ethical responsibility of being persons who are abiding by the rule of law, that are bringing suits that have some factual basis to them, that are not entirely frivolous. And until that happens, lawyers will continue to bring these suits, even though they are entirely frivolous.
Do you think that's going to happen?
I think it requires another step. It requires that you actually bring a complaint to the bar after the lawsuit. And those complaints have not been brought. The strategy and the argument behind not bringing these complaints to the bar is that we don't want to draw this process out, right? To the extent that you are seeking to sanction lawyers, it keeps that particular lawyer in the headlines and potentially that suit in the headlines, and it will give that that suit more air. And so there's been a reluctance to do so. So I don't know if that path is going to happen. I hope it does, to the extent that these lawsuits are brought continuously, but I'm not particularly hopeful right now. And the education of the American people with the stratification of the media, I'm not particularly hopeful with that either. So yeah. I guess I'm feeling pretty pessimistic right now.
Okay. We're going to come back to your pessimism, Bertral, in just a second. Yeah. But Jason Stanley, I do want to hear and discuss and think about how the tentacles of these cases really, it's not just what's happening in the courts, right? It's how the tentacles of the cases really are reaching more deeply into all areas of government and, again, the people's confidence in their government. And what I'm thinking about is the fact that more than 100 Republican lawmakers signed a brief that was filed with the Supreme Court in support of the Trump administration's Trump campaign's attempt to bring this case. Now, these 100-plus lawmakers haven't really talked about the fact that they've signed the brief. They haven't talked about it publicly. They haven't really tweeted about it. It's not actually something they really want to discuss very much. And yet it happened. What does that say?
It says that we're lucky that the Republicans are not in charge of Congress. Some people would say, oh, they only did it because they weren't in charge of Congress. That's something that Ross Douthat floated. He said it's only performative. But, you know, it seems quite alarming. I'm just kind of stunned by the fact that it was, if I'm not mistaken, a majority of Republican Congress people. So a majority of Republican Congress people have essentially signed on to the notion that the election is only legitimate if their candidate won. Now, I want to address something that Professor Ross brought up and is sort of a theme of our conversation, which is that you need to protect the ideals of these institutions, of our democracy, of our democratic institutions and our courts, because people might say that we're being naive here. Because, of course, the courts are not nonpartisan. The courts are quite partisan. Mm-hmm. And there's a sense in which the Trump administration, I mean, they've been packing the courts and making them more partisan. But I still think that it's extremely dangerous to sort of ridicule the ideal of nonpartisanship and independency of the judiciary, because that's an ideal. It's an ideal that we use to make things better. When courts behave in nakedly partisan ways, we can say, look, you're being nakedly partisan. And even though, of course, courts are partisan and have become much more partisan as the result of the Trump administration, the ideal nevertheless has power. When we critique justices as being nakedly partisan, they react in the ways that we're seeing. And just because the ideal isn't a reality doesn't mean it isn't powerful. And what we're seeing is we're seeing a propagandistic attack on the ideals of democratic institutions and democracy. We're seeing them emptied out. And that concerns me, even though one can recognize that there's a big gap between the ideals and reality.
We have about a minute and a half before we have to take our next break, but talk more about that, a propagandistic attack on the ideals of democracy.
Yes, we have. I call it in my How Propaganda Works book, undermining propaganda. When you take a concept like democracy and you advance an anti-democratic goal under the label of democracy, you're making the democratic ideals meaningless. If you advance voter ID laws under the guise of protecting the vote, when there are hardly any instances of in-person same-day voter fraud in the United States. When you do that, you're undermining the democratic ideals because you're just calling something blatantly anti-democratic democratic. And then people just think, okay, the word democracy is just a warfare word. It's a word we use to advance our own ideals and advance our own goals and critique our opponents. And when you do that, then you rob the, you can't say if everyone thinks the courts are nakedly partisan, you can't make judges behave better by accusing them of being nakedly partisan.
Okay, so then from from a philosophical perspective, from your perspective, how do we walk back from that?
That, of course, is the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Okay, well, then I'll let – given that I don't want you to have to answer a million-dollar question in 30 seconds because we've got to take our next break, we'll pause there for a second. I'm talking with Jason Stanley and Bertral Ross today about the democracy stress test. That's what I've been calling it, what 2020 is, and especially on this day when the Electoral College meets to formally cast its votes for President of the United States. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the program, we are going to talk about the COVID pandemic and medical ethics or ethical decisions in healthcare. So we want to hear from you. What kind of factors do you think healthcare professionals should consider when deciding who gets treatment? That has had to happen in American hospitals a lot more than usual this year. What should states be considering as they decide what order to get people vaccinated for COVID? And if you're a healthcare professional, have you had to make ethically fraught decisions because of this pandemic? What were they and how did you think through them? Tell us your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, we are talking about the fact that the Electoral College meets to formally cast its votes for President of the United States. And we're taking another big look at 2020 and the democracy stress test that this country has been undergoing. And I'm joined today by Bertral Ross. He's Chancellor's Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley, a member of the Ad Hoc Committee for 2020 Election Fairness and Legitimacy. Jason Stanley also joins us. He's a professor of philosophy at Yale and author of How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them, and How Propaganda Works. And Bertral and Jason, I was wondering if you might just listen along with us just for a quick couple of minutes here, because I want to circle back to the Electoral College itself, because most of the time, most quadrennial meetings of the EC, it's kind of a step that we don't pay much attention to. Of course, this year it is different. We have seen and heard electors facing pressure and also maybe even threats to subvert the will of the voters. And it's a kind of pressure, actually, that Kara Hollingsworth experienced herself. So it has happened before. She was an elector for Barack Obama in North Carolina back in 2008.
There was something that made it that it wasn't an immediate thing that set in for me that I was going to be an elector, that I was going to be an elector for the first Black president, that I was going to be the elector for the first Black president for North Carolina. So I got letters I got phone calls. I got a FedEx letter from Alaska and was receiving phone calls and letters and didn't realize at the time that as an elector, you're technically considered a public official for that period. So your information is public, whatever you gave them. And so people called me and lobbied me to do my duty as an American citizen and not cast my vote for Barack Obama based on the fact that he was not an American citizen. I actually said to someone the other day, I said, that was a pretty like scary and disheartening experience to have back in 2008. I can't imagine, given the political climate, the violence that we've seen, the, you know, threats that we've seen from Trump supporters, that is not happening to electors today, that they will not face probably even greater and scarier backlash.
That's Kara Hollingsworth. She was an elector for Barack Obama in 2008. Now, Bertral and Jason, we have been focusing almost exclusively on 2020 and Donald Trump. So talk a little bit about what Kara was saying there. I mean, is there something that's always been there under the surface in the United States when it comes to these quadrennial Democratic exercises for us, Bertral?
These exercises have historically been mostly non-eventful, although there have been election episodes in which there have been some controversy with respect to the electors, in which there have been two slates of electors coming from the state, some pressure on electors, as Kara was mentioning in her quotes, on them to shift their votes to the candidate that lost the election. Pressure in 2008, a little bit of pressure in 2000 as well. But I don't know in terms of what's going on with the specific electors right now, but I agree with Kara. I imagine that the pressure on them is probably considerable. And the fact that the Electoral College system, which was supposed to just be a stamp of approval of the, or just a stamp in verifying or validating, mm-hmm. excuse me, the American people's vote, has turned into one in which the folks that are participating in this feel threatened, feel insecure about doing what they're, you know, constitutionally mandated to do. And so that's kind of a worrisome feature that's emerging and I imagine is part of the process this year.
Jason Stanley, go ahead.
So I think all across the world, when you look at countries like Brazil, India, when you look at what's happening with journalism as these far right movements take power, Bolsonaro in Brazil, Modi in India, journalists and politicians and everyone involved in the system encounters a much greater degree of threat. I remember I was at a conference in 2017 when I think someone from the Bergen County Record or Northern New Jersey newspaper was speaking, and he said he was a fact checker. National fact checker. And he said the level of threat that they encountered reminded him of reporting on the mafia or something. So I think that's happening in our country, is that there's just a much greater level of hostility and open hostility from the White House on down, directed against opposition politicians, against journalists trying to do their job. And frankly, it reminds me of what I hear from folks in Brazil and India, where we can look and say they're much further down the road of democratic decline.
So I want to talk more about the long-term impacts of all of this. And there was a interesting poll that caught my attention this week. It was a CBS News poll. And yes, we did a show about all the caveats and the asterisks that have to happen around polling. So yes, being mindful of that. But in the CBS News poll, there were questions about voters' beliefs in the legitimacy of the election. Okay, and so, for example, the poll asked, is Joe Biden the legitimate winner of the 2020 presidential election? And 62% of total respondents said yes. 100% of Biden voters said yes. And only 18% of Trump voters
Wow.
said yes. Okay, so there's a lot. There's other sub cross tabs here. Question: Republicans in Congress should. The options are try to keep Trump in power or move on to other matters. And in terms of try to keep Trump in power, 75% of Trump voters responded and said, yes, that is what they should try to do. Okay. In a sense, that's not really that – I mean, it's disturbing, but not that much of a surprise because of all the things we've been talking about, of the, this month-on-month or year-on-year undermining of belief in the legitimacy of the democratic processes of this country. But you know what really caught my attention is there was a question. Do you think your vote was counted correctly? Okay. 98% of Democrats who responded in this survey said yes. And 78% of Republicans who responded said yes. Overall, 88% of people who responded said yes, they thought their own votes were counted correctly. Meaning that all of this Sturm und Drang is about belief in someone else's vote not being counted correctly or illegitimacy happening somewhere else. Now, Jason Stanley, that feels important to me. I mean, is it?
Yeah, I think so. I think it has to do with the divides that are connecting up, as Professor Ross indicated earlier in the show, with the partisan divides. The racial divide is the most salient, given our country, the most important. But there's also a rural-urban divide that is part of this kind of politics that we're seeing, where, you know, the urban areas are supposed to be disease-ridden, filled with foreigners and minorities and corrupt. So that's an old theme in American politics. It dates back the idea that places with large black populations are corrupt is, you know, was central to the dismantling of Reconstruction. And that's what we're seeing again. So I think we're seeing this idea that in places with minorities, large cities, they're corrupt and the votes haven't been counted correctly. And it connects to the rural-urban politics that is central to the Republican Party today.
So, but then this is a foe that's very difficult to beat, right? I mean, if the boogeyman is constantly somewhere else, this is one of the reasons why conspiracy theories are so powerful, right? It's always out there. It's somewhere else. It can't quite be proven, but it might be there. So when that happens in terms of the democratic consciousness of a country, I guess I'm back to that million-dollar question. Maybe this is – you might get to this in your How Propaganda Works book. What is the anti-propaganda to that?
Well, I think Professor Ross in his work on passive voter suppression addresses this when he talks about how education leads – a lack of education leads people to be disaffected from the voting process. I mean, remember President Trump said he likes the poorly educated. I mean, when you have a complete lack of education, when you have people not understanding the history of the country in which they live – that's going to lead to disaffection with the system, and of course, when government has been incompetent, when government hasn't worked for ages, people will start intense cynicism and to think that the problem lies elsewhere than in their community with the other that they can then blame.
Bertrand, go ahead.
And yeah, in taking what Professor Stanley has said a step further, that cynicism could evolve into something that's a bit more dangerous to our republic in the sense that if you do not think that the democratic system is operating properly, if you do think that the votes of others are being improperly counted because they are cast with fraud or cast by people that should not be able to cast those votes, then you're going to think, well, I need to act in anti-democratic ways to paradoxically save our democracy. And to the extent that you it leads down that path, then we're in a bit of a crisis situation in which there are certain portions of Americans who believe that they not only need to maybe engage in massive protests, which is their perfect right, but to accompany those massive protests with violent acts, with ways and attempts to bring down the government that they do not think legitimately exists or legitimately governs over them. And it's that turn that I worry about. And, you know, as Professor Stanley has written about, these are the turns that lead to fascism that has been too much a part of our world history. And I do not think we're close to that path, or I hope we're not close to that point here, but you can see how the path can be laid to that particular end. And we have to, at least at some point, find a way to stop our progression along that path.
So every time we do a show like this, I get emails from listeners who voted for President Trump. And I want to state something clearly here. Let's hold aside for a moment the members of the Trump campaign and President Trump's legal team, and even elected officials who have been supporting these delegitimizing efforts. They know what they're doing. Holding them aside for a second, but I get emails from voters who listen to this show, and they say, why do you hate us? We're just standing up for our rights. We're standing up for this country. We're protecting the democratic process. There's an authentic feeling about what they're doing, why they voted, and their support for all the legal activity that's gone on this year. So, Jason Stanley, I wonder if you could talk to them for a second. I mean, they're listening right now. What would you tell them about why this moment is so dangerous, and how maybe there are other things we might do collectively as one nation to heal and strengthen our democracy?
I would say that the failure, what has enabled the current political dysfunction, because that's what we have, is complete political dysfunction, is the fault of both parties. We're a country with the highest incarceration rate in the world that will lead repeatedly to large-scale protests against it that happen under Democratic presidents and Republican presidents. Government hasn't worked because of political dysfunction and infighting. And all of us have a stake in government working. And what we should do is we should recognize that we need social conservatives, we need libertarians, we need socialists, we need Black Lives Matter, because there are different solutions to different problems. What we don't need is the otherizing that sets our political opposition as illegitimate tyrants, illegitimate political actors.
Yeah, Bertrand, we've just got a minute, so I'm going to give you the last word here. I mean, one thing which I might encourage listeners to think about is that unless we have to do something to fix this problem, because it seems like we may be paving the way to the next true authoritarian in this country if we don't do something.
As a smaller matter, I would just say it's important for everyone out there to verify and do their due diligence with respect to everything that they're hearing, everything that's alleged. Seek out facts, seek out the truth, seek out understanding of what's really going on. I'm not here to tell you what is the truth and what's not, because that would just be going against the point I'm trying to make, but verify. And the second point I would make is that the president or whoever's your elected leaders, they are elected to represent the entirety of the American people. And it's up to us to hold them accountable and make them responsive to us, and to exercise our rights and exercise our responsibility in keeping government accountable. And I hope that the American people, whether you supported Trump or Biden, Republicans or Democrats, continue to do so over our next 4 years or whatever to keep our American democracy thriving.
Bertrand Ross is Chancellor's Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley. Bertrand, thank you for coming back.
Thank you for having me.
And Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale and author of How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them, and How Propaganda Works. Jason Stanley, thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.